Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society for Ethical Culture. My name is Michael Bogdanfy Cree, and I am president of the Board of Trustees of the Society. While most of you know something about tonight's distinguished speakers, I expect that ethical culture is a bit of a mystery to many of you. The New York Society for Ethical Culture was founded over 125 years ago and has been progressive, liberal, and proud of it from the beginning. Among our outstanding achievements are the founding of the Visiting Nurse Service and the Ethical Culture Fields and Schools. We joined with others to establish the NAACP, the ACLU, the Legal Aid Society, and the New York Committee to Abolish Capital Punishment. Our members have a long tradition of advocacy on civil liberties and human rights issues. We are humanists. We place our faith in a demonstrated capacity of people to do wonderful things. We believe in the worth and dignity of all living beings and seek to respect and protect it. Our conviction is that we must conduct ourselves and the business of our institutions in such a way that we bring out the best in ourselves and everyone else. As a community, we stand for the separation of church and state. We stand for a woman's right to choose. And we stand against the death penalty. Among the commitments we ethical culturists make to ourselves and to the world we live in is the commitment to continuously educate ourselves and others in ways that enable us to all act more considerately and humanely. We are therefore proud to publicly realize that commitment through the donation of our whole for tonight's program on the Iraq War. Membership at Ethical Culture is open to all who share our values. I invite you to get to know us better. Please stop by our table in the lobby where you can pick up literature and sign up to receive notification of future events. You can also check us out on the web at NYSEC, that's NYSEC.org. And now let's get on with tonight's program.
Good evening, I'm Hamilton Fish of the Nation Institute, co-publishers of... Thank you. Good evening, how's that? I'm Hamilton Fish of the Nation Institute, co-publishers of Nation Books. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in New York and our viewers around the country to tonight's conversation. First, a few important items, if they haven't already been addressed. Cell phones, please turn them off. We're going to be doing questions to our panelists. Cards will be passed around. Please fill them out. Pass them to the end of your row. We'll collect them later on in the program. And following the program, there will be a book signing with both of our authors. Books are for sale over in the corner, and I'll explain how the system will work at that time. The Nation Institute has a long tradition of sponsoring public events, dating back to a gathering in the late 1960s in Los Angeles, where Reverend Martin Luther King first voiced his opposition to the Vietnam War. Today we are again immersed in war, a different kind of war, perhaps, but still one that has left mothers all over America grieving over the loss of their children. One such brave woman is with us tonight. She captured our hearts and opened our minds with her vigil in Crawford this summer. Welcome to New York, Cindy Sheehan. Long before Camp Casey, before Abu Ghraib, before the Guantanamo detainees, before 9/11 itself, Scott Ritter was on the ground as the chief weapons inspector for the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq. A former major in the U.S. Marines, Ritter had spent several months of the Gulf War serving under General Norman Schwarzkopf with Marine Central Command headquarters in Saudi Arabia. In 1991, Ritter joined the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team, or UNSCOM, serving for the balance of the decade. He took part in 52 inspections missions, 14 of them as chief. Scott's latest book is Iraq Confidential, his new title from Nation Books, which charts the disillusionment of a patriot who came to realize that in its zeal for regime change, his own government sought to undermine weapons control in the Middle East. And to conduct tonight's conversation, and perhaps to endure some cross-examination himself, we're delighted to welcome legendary investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. He is, of course, the author of the stunning series in the New Yorker magazine on the use of torture by U.S. military and intelligence services in the wake of 9/11. And I should add that Cy was the winner of this year's Ridenour Award, given by the Nation Institute and the Fertel Foundation, in memory of Ron Ridenour, who played a pivotal role in Cy's own groundbreaking reporting on the My Lai massacres during the Vietnam period. The President of the United States based his justification of the invasion of Iraq on the existence of weapons of mass destruction on Iraqi soil and the involvement of Saddam Hussein in the attacks of 9/11. Senior administration officials have repeatedly denied the use of illegal and inhuman treatment of detainees at various U.S. installations around the globe. Mainstream American media has generally parroted these assertions and denials. Because of the courageous work of the two fearless individuals with us tonight, the world now knows the truth. Please welcome Scott Ritter and Seymour Hersh.
What I'm going to do, since make sure if you can't hear me, do yell as if I have to tell you. What I'm going to do is just ask Scott a series of questions, and I've read his book a couple of times, basically we're going to try and have some fun. Consider Scott and I your little orchestra playing on the deck of the Titanic as it goes down, because we're all in great trouble here. Scott, to begin, before we even talk about how we got to where we are, in terms of where we are, the critical question is, the way I look at it, my own personal view is we have two options in Iraq. We can get all our troops out by midnight tonight, A, and option B, we can get them all out by tomorrow night at midnight. And so I wonder where you sit on that. What's your view?
Well... You know, I view that Iraq is a nation that's on fire. I mean, there's a horrific problem that faces not only the people of Iraq, but the United States and the entire world about what's happened in that country. And the fuel that feeds that fire is the presence of American and British troops. This is widely acknowledged by the very generals that are in charge of the military action in Iraq. So the best way to put out the fire is to separate the fuel from the flame. So I'm a big proponent of bringing the troops home as soon as possible. Today's the best day we're going to have in Iraq. Tomorrow's going to be worse, and the day after that's going to be even worse. But we also have to recognize that, you know, one of the reasons why we didn't move to Baghdad in 1991 to take out Saddam was that there was wide recognition that if you get rid of Saddam and you don't have a good idea of what's going to take his place, that Iraq will devolve into chaos and anarchy. Well, we've done just that. We got rid of Saddam, and we have no clue what was going to take his place. And so simply pulling the troops out is only half of the problem. I think there has to be another half of the equation, which is dealing with three critical issues that have emerged since we invaded. A, the Shia. And I'm not talking about the mainstream Shia of Iraq. I'm talking about this political elite that's pro-Iranian that has conducted a coup d'etat, so to speak. They're running the government today. B, the Sunni. We took a secular bulwark against the expansion of radical anti-American Islamic fundamentalism and we've radicalized them themselves. And if we just pull out and leave the situation as it is, we've turned the Sunni heartland, the Sunni triangle, into a festering cesspool of anti-American sentiment. It's the new Afghanistan, the new breeding ground for al-Qaeda. And then one that nobody talks about in the media is the Kurds. We somehow have given the Kurds this false sense that they're going to have an independent homeland. And yet our NATO ally, Turkey, has said this will never happen. And if we allow the Kurds to move forward towards independence, we're compelling the Turks to radical military intervention at a time when Turkey has just been invited to enter into a 15-year negotiation with the European Union about becoming a member of the European community. If the Turks move against the Kurds, that negotiation's over, which means that Turkey has been rejected by Europe and will be heading towards the embrace of radical anti-American Islam. So it's not just about getting the troops out. We have to recognize that there are three huge issues ongoing in Iraq that affect the national security of the United States, and we need a policy to address these. But keeping our troops in Iraq is not part of that policy.
How do you get them out? How quickly? What do you think about that?
The quicker the better. I mean, I'd leave it up to military professionals to determine how you reduce perimeters. There's some areas of the country that you can just literally up and run. But we have a significant force in place. We have significant infrastructure in place. And we have an active insurgency that would take advantage of any weaknesses. But I guarantee you this. If we went to the insurgents, and I do believe that we're having some sort of interaction with the insurgents today, and said, we're getting out of here, all attacks would stop. They'd do everything they can to make sure that the road out of Iraq was as IED-free as possible.
A lot of people disagree with that. A lot of people. This is an administration. One of the things that's always remarkable to me in terms of how the press doesn't push certain issues or, and the Congress, and admittedly, on any given day, in my view of the Congress is that, or the Senate in particular, you can't decide whether they're supine or prone, but they're down. And so we've had along with the Democratic Party. So we've really had a serious problem. But how, a very wise man said to me the other day, somebody that knows the Middle East well and knows the Shia well, he says, you don't even understand your peril. He said, speaking about our country here and this administration, he said, the goal no longer is to remove us out of Iraq. The goal now is to get us out of the Middle East.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think we want to get out of the Middle East until we got some serious issues that Hurricane Katrina has highlighted, our addiction to oil. And until we solve this addiction, we are going to be interacting with the Middle East. And I don't think it's a matter of...
What I actually meant was that it's... The Shia want us out.
No, I'm saying that, but somebody clapped about maybe right. That's a good thing for us to get out of the Middle East. I don't think it's a good thing for us to get out of the Middle East. I think we have a responsibility to our own citizens and indeed to the world to leverage the enormous good that our country represents into doing good in the Middle East. You know, American presence doesn't have to be negative in its connotation. Today, thanks to the Bush administration, when we say an American presence in X country or Y country, it generally has a negative connotation because the Bush administration doesn't have the best interest of the world or even the American people in mind when they carry out a certain course of action. But I do believe that we have to be concerned about this Shia concept. And I would even go further and call it an Iranian concept, where the Iranians are saying that we can take advantage of the serious missteps that the United States has made vis-a-vis Iraq to reassert Iran or Persia as the dominant power in the Middle East. And unfortunately, if we continue to stay the course, as the Republicans and the Bush administration speak of, and indeed many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton and others who aspire to national leadership, stay the course plays right into the Iranian hands.
Needless to say, this isn't a debate. Well, it is too bad, but let's go back to the beginning. One of the things about the book that's amazing is that it's not about the Bush administration. And if there are any villains in this book, I'm talking about Scott's new book, if there are any villains, they include Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, and Madeleine Albright. And basically what this book does... And there's been so much talk. I know we're going to have to deal with it eventually with the New York Times and all the problems there. But one of the things that's breathtaking about this book, in terms of I've always been a newspaper guy, is the amount of new stories and new information. And Scott's describing in more detail and with name sources. Basically a 2 or 3 year run of the American government undercutting the inspection process. And essentially, I think it's fair to say, and the question I would ask is, in your view, all during those years, 91 to 98, particularly the last 3 years when everything got so intense, was the United States interested in disarming Iraq?
Well, the fact of the matter is the United States was never interested in disarming Iraq. The whole Security Council resolution was geared that created the UN weapons inspectors and called upon Iraq to disarm was focused on the one thing and one thing only, and that is a vehicle for the maintenance of economic sanctions that were imposed in August 1990 linked to the liberation of Kuwait. We liberated Kuwait. I participated in that conflict. And one would think, therefore, the sanctions should be lifted. The United States needed to find a vehicle to continue to contain Saddam because the CIA said all we have to do is wait 6 months and Saddam's going to collapse on his own volition. That vehicle is sanctions. They needed a justification. The justification was disarmament. But understand that. A Chapter 7 resolution of the United Nations Security Council calling for the disarm of Iraq and saying in paragraph 14 that if Iraq complies, sanctions will be lifted. Within months of this resolution being passed, and the United States was a drafter and voted in favor of this resolution, within months, the President, George Herbert Walker Bush, and his Secretary of State, James Baker, are saying publicly, not privately, publicly, that even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. That is proof positive that disarmament was only useful insofar as it contained through the maintenance of sanctions and facilitated regime change. It was never about disarmament. It was never about getting rid of weapons of mass destruction. It started with George Herbert Walker Bush, and it was a policy continued through 8 years of the Clinton presidency and then brought us to this current disastrous course of action under the current Bush administration.
One of the things that's overwhelming to me was, and as a journalist, was the notion that everybody believed before March of 03 that Saddam had weapons. This is just an urban myth. The fact of the matter is that in my personal experience, and this I ran into Scott Wendt in about 98, 99, and in talking to people who worked on the UNSCOM and also in the International Atomic Energy Agency, which did a lot of very first-rate reporting, and you know some of the people who wrote some of the reports, former intelligence agents from Britain, among others, they were pretty much clear by 97 that there was very little likelihood that Saddam had weapons. And there were many people in our State Department, our Department of Energy, in the CIA, who didn't believe there were weapons. And I think history is going to judge what I can almost call almost mass hysteria we had about Saddam and weapons. And one of the questions that keeps on coming up now is, why didn't Saddam tell us? Did he tell us?
Well, of course he told. Look, let's be honest. The Iraqis were obligated in 1991 to submit a full declaration listing the totality of their holdings of WMD, and they didn't do this. They lied. They failed to declare a nuclear weapons program, they failed to declare a biological weapons program, and they underdeclared their chemical and ballistic missile capabilities. Saddam Hussein intended to retain a strategic deterrent capability not only to take care of Iran, but also to focus on Israel. What he didn't count on was the tenacity of the inspectors. And very rapidly, by June 1991, we had compelled him into acknowledging that he had a nuclear weapons program. And we pushed him so hard that by the summer of 1991, in the same way that a drug dealer who has police knocking at his door flushes drugs down a toilet to get rid of his stash so they can tell the cops, I don't have any drugs, the Iraqis, not wanting to admit that they lied, flushed their stash down the toilet. They blew up all their weapons and buried it in the desert, and then tried to maintain the fiction that they had told the truth. And by 1992, they were compelled, again, because of the tenacity of the inspectors, to come clean. People say, why didn't Saddam Hussein admit being disarmed? In 1992, they submitted a declaration that said, everything's been destroyed, we have nothing left. In 1995, they turned over the totality of their document cache. Again, not willingly. It took years of inspections to pressure them. But the bottom line is, by 1995, there were no more weapons in Iraq. There were no more documents in Iraq. There was no more production capability in Iraq, because we were monitoring the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure with the most technologically advanced, the most intrusive arms control regime in the history of arms control. And we knew that while we couldn't account for everything that the Iraqis said they had destroyed, we could only account for 90-95%. We knew that, A, we had no evidence of a retained capability, and B, no evidence that Iraq was reconstituting. And furthermore, the CIA knew this. The British intelligence knew this. Israeli intelligence knew this. German intelligence. The whole world knew this. They weren't going to say that Iraq was disarmed, because nobody could say that. But they definitely knew that the Iraqi capability regarding WMD had been reduced to as near to zero as you could bring it, and that Iraq represented a threat to no one when it came to weapons of mass destruction.
But you were very worried all the way through the end about what you call the concealment mechanism. Why don't you tell the audience about that?
Well, the concealment mechanism, I mean, you know, here's the thing. Hussein Kamal, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, defects in August of 1995. And he's debriefed by the CIA, by British intelligence, and by UN weapons inspectors. And his debriefing on all three occasions is consistent on two things. One, all weapons had been destroyed. Hussein Kamal repeated this over and over and over again. There's nothing left in Iraq, he said. But then he talked about what happened in 1991, and he said, Saddam's bodyguards, the Special Republican Guard, the Special Security Organization, they were hiding weapons back then, and they're still hiding documents and components today. And you need to go after these guys. And so that's what we did. I mean, you know, we had been lied to by the Iraqis in 1991. They had a mechanism in place then to hide things from us. The Iraqis have come clean about the fact that they hid things and where they are, but they never talked about how they hid it. And now we're being told that it's ongoing today. So now we have to investigate what occurred in 1991, who did it, and then we have to make sure that it's been disbanded and that they're not doing it today. Unfortunately, that means going after Saddam Hussein's security. This is like the Iranians coming in and telling the United States that we want to investigate the Secret Service and how they protect the president. There's no way Americans would let that happen. And there was no way the Iraqis were going to bend over and let us come in and inspect Saddam Hussein's security forces.
The other element in all of this, of course, is that, as Scott writes about, there were things going on inside his own organization that he didn't know about. Operations being run by the CIA, and in effect, I think it's not an overstatement to say, in your book, in your belief anyway, and by the way, I can say that as a journalist, I've independently talked to people and verified much of this, all of it. One of the things that was going on is we provoked Saddam and demanded to get into, as your group did, the UN did, demanded to get to the palaces. Their concern was, of course, that the real meaning, the real effort was to assassinate him. And lo and behold.
Well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, look, the American policy was regime change. At first, they wanted to be passive. We're just going to contain Saddam through economic sanctions, and he's going to collapse on his own volition in 6 months. That failed. We're going to put pressure on the Iraqis, and we're going to get some Sunni general to apply the 75-cent solution, the cost of a 9-millimeter bullet put in the back of Saddam's head, and a Sunni general will take over. If you want proof positive about the corrupt nature of our regime change policy, understand this. It wasn't about changing the regime. It wasn't about getting rid of the Ba'athist Party or transforming Iraq into a modern democracy back in the early 1990s. It was about getting rid of one man, Saddam Hussein. And if he was replaced by a Sunni general who governed Iraq in the exact same fashion, that was okay. And that shows the utter hypocrisy of everything we did. But the CIA was having a difficult time getting near Saddam because he has this outstanding, and I don't mean that in terms of a bunch of good guys, but a very effective security apparatus. By 1995, Saddam's continued survival became a political liability to Bill Clinton. And he was coming up for re-election in 96, and he turned to the CIA and said, get rid of Saddam by the summer of 1996. I need that man gone. The CIA worked with British intelligence. They brought in somebody named Iyad Alawi. Might be a name familiar to people. He was, for a period of time, the interim prime minister of Iraq after the American occupation. Before he was interim prime minister, however, he was a paid agent of British intelligence and the CIA. And he worked with them to orchestrate this coup d'etat that required them to recruit people on the inside of Iraq to be ready to take out Saddam. But you needed a trigger. And the trigger was a UN weapons inspection that I helped organize. We thought we were going after the concealment mechanism, but it turned out that the CIA was setting us up so that we would go to facilities that housed Saddam's security. We would be blocked. It was anticipated they would block us. And then when we withdrew, there would be a military strike that would decapitate the security of Saddam. The one place that we wanted to go to, the 3rd Battalion, we weren't allowed to. The CIA said, don't worry about that. We know those guys. They're not bad. And they were supposed to rise up and take Saddam out. Well, the Iraqi intelligence service is very effective at infiltrating this coup. They wrapped it up, and nothing happened in terms of getting rid of Saddam, except one thing. The Iraqis were fully aware of the role played by the CIA in infiltrating UNSCOM and using UNSCOM for own devices. And the ultimate tragedy of this is that from that point on, every time a UN weapons inspector went into Iraq, somebody with a blue hat, they weren't viewed by the Iraqis as somebody who was trying to disarm Iraq. They were viewed by the Iraqis as somebody trying to kill their president, and they were right.
When did you learn about this?
We always knew about regime change. I mean, when I first came in, we knew about regime change. In terms of the infiltration, some people say it's my fault because I'm the guy that brought in the character I call Mo Dobbs and the special activities staff, the covert operators of the CIA. We used them in 1992. We used them in 1993 because it's tough to do inspections in Iraq. They're not necessarily the friendliest people in the world when you're trying to go to a site that they don't want you to get in. And you can't have a bunch of thin-necked, geeky scientists trying to do this job. You need guys...
Are you talking about New Yorkers?
No. But you need guys with thick necks and thick arms. And the CIA had plenty of these guys who could do logistics. They could do planning. They could do communications in austere environments. So we used these guys. And we used them in June. The problem came afterwards when we started doing follow-up inspections. First of all, the Iraqis would come to me. And they would say, Mr. Ritter, what are you doing? You're supposed to be an inspector, and yet you're doing all this bad stuff. We know about the CIA's coup attempt. And I'm going, what coup attempt? We know what happened in June. But what happened in June? And suddenly we start inspecting sites, and I see documents that start sending off signals in my head about, oh, my gosh, the unit the CIA didn't want us to go to was the unit that was liquidated by Saddam Hussein in the aftermath of the failed coup, because that was the unit that was trying to take out Saddam. And suddenly the light goes off and you're sitting there going, we've had the wool pulled over our eyes. We've been used. We were used by the United States, though. And they're the most powerful nation on the Security Council that we as inspectors work for. So how do you turn to your boss and say, hey, you've used us. We won't tolerate that. Well, you can't do that. What you have to do is continue to plod forward and just redouble your efforts to maintain the integrity of a process that tragically had been terminally corrupted by that point.
So, let's see. We've got the Clinton administration looking really good here. What I always say, when I do speeches, I always start by saying, the bad news is, let's see now, there's 1,190 days left of the Bush presidency. And the good news is, tomorrow morning there'll be one less. And so the question is, so if Clinton wasn't so good, where are we now?
Well, I'll start off and I want to highlight that point that Clinton wasn't so good. There's a lot of talk today in the Democratic-controlled Judiciary Committee about going after the Bush administration for crimes, for lying to Congress, and et cetera. And, I'm all in favor of that. Bring on the indictments, but don't stop with the Bush administration. If you want to have a truly bipartisan indictment, take it down and you indict Madeleine Albright, you indict Sandy Berger, you indict every person on the Clinton administration that committed the exact same crime that the Bush administration has committed to today, lying during the course of your official duty. That's a felony. That's a high crime and misdemeanor. That's language in the Constitution that triggers certain events like impeachment. So let's not just simply turn this into a Bush-bashing event. This is about a failure not only of the Bush administration, but of the United States of America. And we have to look in the mirror and recognize that what all the Bush administration did is take advantage of a systemic failure on the part of the United States as a whole, a failure that not only involves the executive, but it involves the legislative branch, Congress, whether they're prone or supine, whatever you want to say. Congress has abrogated its responsibilities under the Constitution, and they've abrogated it for years. Then there's the media. And yes, we can turn this into a media bashing event. But you know what? The media only feeds the American people the poison they're willing to swallow. And we, the people of the United States of America, seem to want our news in no more than 3-minute chunks with sound bites of 30 seconds or less. And it can't be too complicated. And so what we did is allowed ourselves throughout the decade of the 1990s to be pre-programmed into accepting at face value without question anything that was negative about Saddam Hussein's regime. And this made selling the war on Iraq on the basis of a lie the easiest task ever faced by the Bush administration.
There's always the argument that one virtue of what we did, no matter how bad it is, we got rid of a very bad dictator. What do you, you know, I have my answer to that. What's your answer to that one?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what your answer is. But, that, you know, look, that invokes the notion of the ends justify the means. I mean, that's basically what we're saying here is that who cares about the lie? Who cares about the WMD? You know, we got rid of a bad guy. The ends justify the means. And I have to be frank. If there's anybody here who calls themselves a citizen of the United States of America and you endorse the notion of the ends justify the means, submit your passport for destruction and get the hell out of my country. Because this is a country that is founded on the rule of law as set forth by the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution that the men and women who serve us swore an oath of allegiance to, the Constitution that our government, every government official, swears an oath of allegiance to, and it's about due process. Democracy is ugly. Sometimes it doesn't work as smoothly as we want it to. But if you're sitting here and saying that when it comes to Saddam that the ends justify the mean, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? And you can't say, tell me that it's only going to stop here. It's about the rule of law. It's about the Constitution. And if we wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein, then we should have had a debate, discussion, and dialogue about the real reasons and not make up some artificiality called weapons of mass destruction.
This is not Plato's Republic. I mean, Scott. and there are a lot of realities. There are a lot of give and take on all these issues. For example, I always joke, and I think I mean it. The one thing Bill Clinton did that strikes me as remarkable is he was the first American president since World War II to actually bomb white people in Kosovo. So there is some good. He isn't as bad. It's just the real issue for me in this issue, in the Bush administration and the ease with which, you know, the ease with which they move from the attack on 9/11 into an invasion of Afghanistan. And let me assure you, the whole story of that, I'm doing work on it, but the whole story in that isn't as simple. The idea that you're just going to go after all the Taliban, wasn't that clean a decision. It was a lot of give and take that we didn't see publicly. But the ease in which we moved into the war in Iraq, it does strike me as getting at the fabric of democracy, because we literally were taken over, I think. I think it's not an exaggeration to say, by 8 or 9 neocons, a cult, if you will. And we were taken over, and there was, for all of your talk about, and I know you mean it, and I know there are many people who served in the military who share your view and are just as vibrant about it as you are. But yet, the military has been totally docile. We haven't had one senior officer go public. As we can trash the Congress all we want, and we'd still be ahead of the game. The bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy, we saw an awful lot of acquiescence. The press has been, this is, I think history will judge, this is one of the low points of the response to Bush will be a low point for the American press corps. So where are we? Where do we go from there? How powerful is democracy? How close are we to the edge? What happens now?
Well, the deal about democracy, especially American democracy, is that it's supposed to be a participation event. You know, we've got this wonderful thing called the Constitution. A, I'd like Americans to start reading the Constitution and understanding what that document means. That way, maybe people wouldn't sit there and say, well, Scott Ritter, it's pie in the sky, Plato's Republic. No, it's not. It's what we stand for. It's what the values and ideals of our nation are. They're enshrined in that document. And there's no other document in the world like it. But the fact that most Americans have it, you know, my wife comes from the former Soviet Union. She had to actually study the Constitution and take a test on the Constitution before she became a citizen. And so she knows the Constitution better than the vast majority of natural-born Americans. And so Americans need to start to come to grips of who they are, because unless you know the Constitution, understand what representative democracy means, and that's not just about voting people in, it's about holding people accountable for what they do in your name, then you're not a citizen, and that's what we lack, is citizenship.
But let me ask you this. As somebody who knows the military pretty well, what about the failure of the military to speak out? I mean, what do you think? I know there's no answer, but what do you think?
I have a hard time blaming the military for this. There's a gentleman, he's a colonel on active duty today, H.R. McMaster, that wrote a great book about the Vietnam War called Dereliction of Duty. And it's about the failure of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to stand up and do the right thing about Vietnam. And the same dereliction of duty is taking place today by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Yes, I agree. There comes a time when you're a senior officer in the U.S. military, when you see the civilian leadership behaving in the manner that they are. It's not about picking up the phone and calling a journalist, and I know that would do you great harm if they stopped doing that, but it's about taking the stars off your collar and throwing them on the table and say, I will not be a part of this charade. And nobody's been willing to do that.
But let's get back to reality. Where's McMaster now? Do you know?
Well, McMaster's a brigade commander in Iraq. I think he ran combat operations in Tal Afar.
He was the brigade commander in Tal Afar. I can tell you that's the operation that took place a few months ago in northern Iraq. The worst part of it took place during Katrina. There were men in the military who were very happy about the lack of American attention. Well, of course, it's been dwindling anyway. At one point, I'm told, we had more than 100 raids, air raids, on that village. I've had officers come back and use the word genocide and talking about turning in their colonel. What is it? Bird? Wings?
Birds, yeah.
What is it? Turning in his
they're full bird colonels, his eagle wings.
His eagles. Okay, turning in his eagles. Talking to me about what they consider to be genocide, and at one point the Turkish Red Crescent, the Red Cross from Turkey, came across and offered to provide some support for the 200,000 people of Tal Afar that had been bombed, given in obscurity because of Katrina, and they were told no by us. And so what is the system that makes a guy like McMaster, who could write such a brilliant book, about which the generals still talk? They still get together, the generals still talk about their lack of morality or amorality or whatever it is. They worry about it in their own private meetings. I've talked to people who've gone, they meet together three or four times a year. So what is it about this war, this president? Where are we with this stuff? What's going to happen? Who's going to break out and tell us the war there? In case anybody has any illusions, if you were to read the Arab press about what's going on every day, when we have stories talking about guys in the New York Times the other day, maybe yesterday, pilots flying supersonic jets saying they saw 25 to 40 insurgents go into a building, so they destroyed the building, killing that many insurgents. Insurgents is the new word for body count. And it just goes down so smoothly. I just see it happen. The press just automatically glams on to the notion that everybody we say is an insurgent is, and yet if you look at Al Hayat and the other press, and you get a sense every day those papers are filled with little children dying, being maimed, and the amount of hatred that's being generated against us, the amount of resentment, the number of jihadists we're creating, the war in Iraq is not an external war, it's an indigenous war, and it's getting worse. So why not blame the military? Why not say one of those guys should speak out?
Well, I'm not saying that they shouldn't speak out. I mean, you know, it would be wonderful, and it's not pressure on H.R. McMaster's, but if he set the example, if he came back from Iraq and said, this is a war that's not only unwinnable, but this is a war that's morally unacceptable, and I can no longer participate in this conflict, and he resigned. Who knows, that might set the standard for other men of honor to step forward. But it's a very difficult thing to ask a soldier to do what the average American citizen won't. I mean, why do we put the burden on the soldier to speak out instead of putting the burden on the American public to become more empowered, to become enraged about what's happening, to vote out of office? We've got an election coming up in 2006. Rather than waiting for McMaster's to resign, why don't we vote out of Congress everybody who voted in favor of this war?
Well,
and I know I don't live in reality, but it's still.
Well, so let's talk about the press a minute. We got to get to that a little bit. And you're going to want, I think we're going to want questions eventually, right? Let me read you some stuff that was said about you. This is my favorite one, actually. I'm not picking on the New York Times, but it just happens to be my favorite one. It was a long piece that was done about Scott in the fall of 02. November. Would have been 5 months before the invasion. And the headline of the piece is Scott Ritter. It's a magazine piece. Scott Ritter's Iraq Complex. And it says, war definitely is Ritter's prediction. He told me this the other day. He sees no room for optimism. He said he was talking about the Security Council at this time, if you remember, the Bush administration and Blair, the eternal puppy dog, I guess. We're talking about going back to the UN, and he said it's just a setup, a smokescreen. The Bush administration has put his reputation on the line. This is Scott talking. Whether or not weapons are found, expect the bombing to begin. He says, he talked about, Scott is quoted as saying, the presidential palaces in Iraq may have underground bunkers, but they're not underground factories. Quote, there's no James Bond, there's no Dr. Evil, the Iraqis are incompetent, they can't do it. And my favorite line is the next one, well, maybe they could. So why couldn't you get the press to take you seriously?
Well, one of the problems is that the press wasn't looking to have a discussion based on reality, because that's too nuanced, that's too complicated, that's too gray. The press wanted black and white. And it also, the problem was, you know, you have this former Marine, former hard-nosed weapons inspector,
who was bitching a lot about the Iraqis all
right,
along.
Yeah,
Right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
A man singled out by Saddam Hussein is, you know, the personification of evil, suddenly gone soft. And that was just a combination that the press didn't know how to deal with.
You flip-flopped, they said.
I was a flip-flopper. And so rather than deal with the complexity of a problem, and believe me, there's no single answer to many of these questions. The WMD issue in the lead up to the war was one that I was not saying that Iraq had no WMD. I said that the inspectors had never completed their job. We needed to let the inspectors go back in and finish the job before we talk about going to war. That when the president says he knows that there can be no doubt that there's WMD in Iraq, that implies certainty of knowledge that has to be based upon fact, and that this administration had failed to put any of that fact on the table. And all I was asking is that the administration make its case, because short of that case, we can't talk about going to war. We need to let the inspectors do their job. And that's too complicated for Barry Bierak, that author, and other people out there who, frankly speaking, didn't know how to deal with this guy called Ritter and the message he was trying to put out there.
But in terms of Saddam, do you think maybe we need fixes? We need a Hitler fix? Seems to me that we've gone from Hitler, we go to Stalin, we go to Mao, we go to Zhou Enlai, we go to Khrushchev, we go to, at some point, Gaddafi, certainly Khomeini. You run through the list. We seem to always be fixated on, you know, Dr. Evil, I guess, to use that cliche. So is that it, that we're so easily brainwashed into thinking that Saddam, who's by nothing, nobody's suggesting that he's not, you know, this is despicable, et cetera. Let's make that, there's no apology here, obviously, for him. But there are an awful lot of very bad people out there. And, why, what a horrible thing to say. That others may see us. You know, I'll tell you what I think a lot about. I think about the bombing. And here's what I think about in this war. Bombing is an integral part of this war. And you will find next year, as this president tries to extricate himself politically and before the congressional elections, you will find he's going to trade American soldiers for American bombs. And since this war began, there's been no air defenses of the Iraqis. We have seen no statistics on how many bombs get dropped, sorties they call it, how many flights, how many missions by one plane, by each plane, a sortie. We have no statistics. We don't have embedded reporters on the carriers that are in the Gulf. We don't have embedded reporters in the air bases in Doha and other places that fly round-the-clock missions. We just don't know. Were there 100 missions a day at Tal Afar? How many missions are being flown right now? Is it exponentially increase? And our ignorance and willingness to remain ignorant, and I fault the press too, the inability to ask questions. Why shouldn't a bomb that falls in a house and kills a mother, father, and six siblings, leaving a 15-year-old boy to determine he's going to spend the rest of his life getting revenge, why isn't that as much of a terror weapon, an American bomb, as an IED or a car bomber? Well, the answer is it is. It is. And it's an amazing sort of inability to look at it from that way. But do you have any optimism as we get done with our little thing here?
No. I wish I did. I mean, the sad fact is, one of the reasons why I was arguing against this war was not just that it was based on a lie, but it's a reflection of the reality that was recognized in 1991, that if you remove Saddam and you don't have a clue what's going to replace Saddam, you're going to get chaos and anarchy. And so people continue to say they want the elegant solution in Iraq. I mean, that's the problem. Everybody's like, well, we can't withdraw because we've got to solve all the problems. Ladies and gentlemen, there's not going to be an elegant solution in Iraq. There's no magic wand that can be waved to solve this problem. Yeah, well, look, if we get out and we have a plan, you know, it's still going to cost 30,000 Iraqi lives. Let's understand that. There's going to be blood shed in Iraq. They're going to kill each other, and we're not going to stop it. If we continue to stay the course, however, that 30,000 number may become 60 or 90,000. At the end of the day, we've created a nightmare scenario in Iraq, and the best we can do is mitigate failure. And that's what I'm talking. And unfortunately, that's a politically unacceptable answer. People say, no, we have to win. We have to persevere. There has to be victory. There's not going to be victory.
What about the chances of expanding the war? What about the chances of expanding the war into Syria or even, you know, into Iran?
Well, the sad thing right
not that's just cross-border stuff.
The sad thing right now is that we have a Bush administration that's populated by people that don't understand war. They've never been in the military, they've never served in combat, and they don't know what it means to have a son die, or to have a friend die, or have a brother die, or have a comrade die. And so that's why you have a Secretary of State like Condoleezza Rice who has the gall to stand before the American people and say that war is the only guarantor of peace and security. And now she testified before the U.S. Congress today, and she said that not only is Iraq probably going to be another 10-year investment of time, blood, and national treasure for the American public, but that Syria and Iran may very well be the next targets of the Bush administration. So this administration has learned nothing. But what's worse is that Congress has learned nothing. There were no tough questions to Condoleezza Rice. And now we have the American people. What lessons have we learned? What actions are we going to take? Where's the American media? And that's a good question I have for you. Where is the American media?
Well, somebody I know, high up official who disagrees, off the record, of course, or privately, said to me about Condi. He said, well, when she became Secretary of State, we all heard that she'd have the president's ear, but we didn't know that all she'd do is lick it. Oh, I don't know what to tell you about the press. You know, until this week, I was always, because I spent so many years at the New York Times, and the New York Times is, for all of its fault, it's our national standard. It's the paper by which certainly during Watergate, and when I was writing for it from 72 to 79, I felt that writing about Vietnam and writing about the coup in Chile and writing about my favorite born again liar, Mr. Kissinger, you could really write with great freedom. And it's sometimes I think, and just going through the carefully looking at the stuff over the last few days, I think sometimes that maybe the solution, the New York Times Corporation is a very big industry. It's got a lot of internet, a lot of cable companies, other media, radio stations. Maybe they should just spin it off to somebody, you know, who knows how to run a newspaper. Because, Murdoch. Or maybe there's a good suburban newspaper chain in Westchester or the northern New Jersey. Or maybe a bunch of kids in the Yale Daily News could get their daddies to cough up enough money to buy it and they could take it over. But somebody's got to do something because it's too important an institution to be floundering the way it is. And we all have a stake. I asked somebody who worked there, we all have a stake in making this paper and urging it to get better quick. Because it is a paper that essentially failed in the mission it had against Bush. It had a mission to tell the truth and it did not. And please, you can't just blame Judy Miller. It's not that simple. No. You know, I'll tell you something about that story. What interests me no end is that she had been doing what she's been doing for 6 or 7 years. And there was no question about where she stood, and particularly the last 3 years, about who she was dealing with. And here comes the Joe Wilson story. She's an expert, allegedly, in the Times on WMD, weapons of mass destruction. She was with the early teams that went into the war. She wrote about it from the administration's point of view, but she certainly was an expert. Here's Joe Wilson. He writes an op-ed, and we know she knew about it in advance, but assuming even otherwise, the editors may not have known what she knew. And he writes this dramatic story about the administration being caught out in a definitive way by from somebody inside. Here's somebody inside and said something of importance, and it's not an anonymous source. And she's not assigned to do the story. Why? To me, because they understood what she did and who she worked with. So the paper was empowering her in a way. In other words, an honest journalist, would, the expert you'd want, if you had a perception that she was an honest, straight journalist, you could do it. And so that's not her failing. That's an institutional failing, that it was recognized that she only represented that side of the house. And that's not the paper I knew. And that's not the paper we should stand for. Let's do some questions. Okay, I just did the first one. Talk about the reporting of Judy Miller. I think that was coming. Can we talk about the likelihood of a Bush administration attack on Iran, what it might involve, and what the results might be? You want to do some of these? You want to read them? No, you read them. I don't care.
Well,
let me do this. We should answer that question.
Okay, tackle it.
Iran's not going to give up the nuclear weapons. It's a country, Cyrus the Great. They're not going to give up the weapons.
They're
not going to give up their ambitions then, let's put it that way. Those are all factoids. The fact is they have an ambition. They weren't very straight about it. They misled the IAEA. This guy won a Nobel Prize because he had an awful lot of integrity, Al-Baridi. And so, their hands aren't, admittedly from their point of view, if they're surrounded by people with bombs who won't, have bombs who aren't their friends. They have Israel, which is always in any discussion, the elephant in the room of any policy. They have Israel viewing, Iran as the existential threat. I think it does. The leadership there does as an existential threat, certainly more than Iraq. And, what scares the hell out of me is I know some of the things they're doing. We haven't stopped very aggressive actions against them, very aggressive, covert actions. We've been doing, increasing it. We've been making threatening, very threatening, explicit threats of the most horrific kind. And every wise man I know says to me that we can't do it. We just can't do it because it's Iran is too powerful. We don't have an armed forces. If we did do it, there would be, if you think Osama bin Laden caused trouble here on 9/11, there are 3 million Iranians in America. You would see things happen here that would be unbelievable.
Sai, a question for both of you. To what extent do you consider the maintenance of perpetual war a priority for this administration to fuel high military spending, continued military spending?
I don't know about fueling continued military spending. I've always likened the neocons as parasites who attach themselves to hosts. And they've attached themselves to the Republican Party, a party that I'm a member of. And I know that elicits hissing and booing in many corners of America today. But
gives you credibility here.
The neocons are a minority element of the far right wing of the Republican Party. These are people who flourished in the 1980s during the Reagan administration when they had the evil empire. And because you had an evil empire, because they had a focus, they could sit there and talk about certain empowering devices such as, you know, programs to build weaponry, programs that exploited the fear and the ignorance of the American public. When the Soviet Union went away, the neocons were at a loss. What do? You need something to replace it. That's where Paul Wolfowitz and others came up with the idea of stepping into the vacuum and talking about global domination. And they wrote a variety of papers that came out first in 1992, then in 1997 as the vision statement of the Project for a New American Century. And today it's manifested itself as the National Security Strategy of the United States, which were promulgated in September 2002, 1 year to the date after the September 11th attacks. And I think this is a vehicle that does create the conditions of perpetual war, because with perpetual war, you have perpetual fear. And when the American people are perpetually ignorant, this fear can be exploited, and it's been exploited very, very effectively by the Bush administration and their neoconservative parasites.
Scott, you raised the three-part issue, Sunnis, Kurds, and Shias, but you don't paint the rest of the picture. What is the rest of the picture, and can you flesh out with Iran, Turkey, and Israel in the region?
Well, I raised the three issues that are internal to Iraq, which are the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. What I didn't talk about is the solution. I said withdraw troops. Look, that's first and foremost. The boys and girls got to come home, and they got to come home now. Unfortunately, they're not going to. But let's say we get them home. How do we deal with these three issues? It's going to require a multilateral approach with the United States playing a role, not necessarily the leading role. You need the Turks to give the Kurds of Iraq assurances that legitimate autonomy will be respected. And we can work with the Turks on that because we have one hell of a leverage called European Union membership. You need the Syrians to work with the Sunni to talk about walking away from Wahhabism, to get back to that secular base. And we have leverage with the Syrians. I think Sai could probably talk about the role that the Syrians' intelligence has played in being the true supporter of the American war on terror. Syria has provided, my understanding, is some of the best intelligence about al-Qaeda. Jordan will play an important role. Saudi Arabia will play an important role. Kuwait will play an important role. And you know what? The Iranians will play an important role because, again, we have leverage. We can leverage a recognition of an Iranian nuclear energy program under full IAEA safeguards. We can leverage a lifting of the economic embargo that we've imposed on Iran to get the Iranians to back off on Iraq. It's difficult. It's not easy. But you know what? It's called diplomacy, and that's a lost art form here in the United States.
No. Should add also, in order to do that, this president, this administration would have to talk to the Syrians and the Iranians, and so far they have not, and officially to the insurgents, too.
Scott, Israel has the arsenal of nuclear bombs. Why is Israel immune from inspections?
The easy answer is they're immune from inspections because there's no mandate out there to inspect Israel. Now, the question is, why is there no mandate out there to inspect Israel? Because the United States of America is a veto-wielding member of the Security Council, and we will never allow a resolution to be chaired that threatens the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Worse, we will never allow the Israeli nuclear weapons program to be interjected into the debate. We just pretend it doesn't exist. We hold Iran accountable for the non-proliferation treaty when, in fact, Iran has not violated the non-proliferation treaty. Iran is complying with the non-proliferation treaty, and yet we pretend that Israel's doing nothing wrong. Now, I'm a very fervent supporter of the state of Israel. I believe Israel has a right to exist, and I believe that we should work with Israel to develop the means of peacefully coexisting with their neighbors. But you know, it has to be based on the same standard. And when we have this double standard, we say the Israelis can do whatever they want, including working with a nuclear weapons program, and nobody else in the world can. That's a policy formulation for disaster.
Two questioners come at this from different angles. One asks, why is no one talking about the civilian casualties caused by military action in Iraq? And the other reports that she read the DOD website the other day, where apparently they list 5 civilian deaths.
No. Those questions answer themselves. I will say something about Israel. In this book, Scott describes in great detail how competent he eventually turned away from America and its intelligence services and took much of the of some of the raw intelligence that had to be analyzed, overhead camera work and intercepts, to the Israelis because they could do it better, quicker, and ended up people thinking you were what, an Israeli agent?
Well, I was accused of being an Israeli spy, but you know, the Israelis brought more integrity to that process than the United States and the CIA ever did. When I started in 1994, Iraq was the number one threat to the state of Israel. This was put out in the official Israeli National Intelligence Estimate. When I left in 1998, Iraq was number 6 and falling. And the reason is that the Israelis had actually embraced the process of disarmament that was represented by the UN weapons inspectors. When you do intelligence cooperation with a nation, it's imperative, especially as a weapons inspector, that, you know, it's a give-and-take relationship. And it's very difficult. You have to give information, they give you a response, and it's a feedback loop. So it's an intelligence cycle, and it requires close cooperation. If Israel could very well have used the information that we were providing them to target Saddam Hussein and remove Saddam Hussein and to carry out a very aggressive policy against Iraq. But the Israelis recognized that if you remove Saddam, you got a bigger problem than simply keeping Saddam. And they treated the intelligence with an integrity that was lacking in the United States. The United States took everything we gave them, and instead of helping us disarm Iraq, they went out and targeted Saddam Hussein.
On September 13th, the Financial Times reported that the Pentagon is seeking authorization for preemptive nuclear strikes against nations having weapons of mass destruction or terrorist groups. Please comment on the likelihood of use.
Well, that memo was part of what I mentioned earlier about doing sorts everything they could to push Iran. That memo was part of a concerted effort. In that report, they also publicly said, I think it was in that paper, but my memory is they publicly said that they are returning tactical nuclear weapons, small, low-yield nuclear weapons, to the Navy fleet in the Gulf, off Iran. And that was part of what worries the hell out of me, because that they also were doing what we call toss bombing. You know what toss bombing is. It's simulated nuclear bombing runs. To drop a nuclear weapon, a tactical weapon, by an airplane, its release comes when you go back. You go backwards after you make your dive. You come out and you go back and you toss it up so you have more time to get away. We've been doing some of those activities, practice runs, in clear sight of Iranian radar. So they're trying. It's very provocative. They're trying to pass messages. I'm not suggesting that it's on the table, but. You know, the trouble with utopians is, and when Scott was talking about the neocons and Wolfowitz deciding this or that, unlike somebody like Kissinger, these guys really believe this. I mean, this is something they believe. And a utopian who, an idea fixe, democracy must come to the Middle East at all costs, no matter much. If we lost 2,000 people, we've got to lose 2,000 more men and women to justify it. It's really scary when you have a man who, from what I gather, believes that he is a crusader in every sense of that word, and has no restraint. There's no informational restraint. There's no common sense restraint. There's no restraint from the media. There's no reaction. He couldn't care less. Couldn't care less about what we write or say. That's one of the problems. He's a nerd to us. And so we're really in a dangerous spot. We have a vehicle. We have a man firing away. And how do you stop him? I don't know.
Mr. Hirsch, this is a question for you, Cy. Do you think that a tripartite state, as has been posited by Peter Galbraith and others, a Sunni, Shia, Kurd tripartite state in Iraq, do you consider it viable, and in particular, the Kurdish state?
Oh, I think it's absolutely the perfect, horrible trifecta. You're going to get a Shiite state in the south that's going to work very closely under the hands of the Iranians, be much more aggressive and hostile to Israel, which is not a policy that we want. You're going to get, I always used to say, you're going to get Somalia in the center of the country, the Sunni land. Right now, what we're doing in the Sunni land, if anybody has any doubt, we're simply killing people. The goal is to make the Sunnis more frightened of us than the insurgency. That's how we're going to try and get intelligence. And that's what we're doing, bam, bam, bam. And in the north, a friend of mine teaches at one of the war colleges, and he has some Turkish officers in the course, and they said nothing. They were discussing the formation of a Kurdistan, independent Kurdistan. And finally, my friend asked one of the colonels, "Sir, you know, Colonel, what do you think about Kurdistan?" And he said, "Sir," he said, "there is no Kurdistan. I mean, it's not going to be pretty." And I don't know. I disagree with you is I don't think we'll do anything to be able to keep the Turks out of there. I think we could be looking at a serious war there. And these guys just go along dancing their game, spinning it out, making threats as Condi did today to Congress, not being challenged on it publicly by anybody in the Congress. Is that right? There was very few, no acrimony?
No, there was nobody took her on. They just sat there like compliant little servants and listened to Condi dictate, and that was the end of the debate.
They licked her ear.
But what also gets me on the issue of breaking Iraq up into three separate entities, because this is an argument that's put out there, it's just basically correcting the mistake of history, that Iraq is not a genuine nation state, it's an artificial construct that emerged at the end of the First World War, etc. And what astounding hubris one must have to think that the United States of America is empowered to go back and redraw the lines on the map anywhere in the world because we're correcting a mistake of history. The mistake of history is being made by embracing such an absurd notion that we have the ability to come in and divide up a group of people without really consulting the people themselves.
I'd like to address a couple of questions that deal more directly with domestic politics and activism. Tens of thousands of Americans converged on Washington last month against the war. Cindy Sheehan reignited the anti-war movement, and now someone is camping out by Blair's house. Yet everyone still feels disempowered. What more can Americans do? Many members of Congress voted for the war based on misinformation. Should all of them be voted out of office?
The short answer is yes. I think that, you know, when people, look, I'm going to get in trouble with the anti-war movement here, but I'm just going to tell you my personal opinion. You know, these demonstrations that take place, you know, 100,000 people get together, they hold hands, they light candles, they sing Kumbaya, then they go home. And there's no follow-through. It's an exercise in self-gratification. And there's no follow-up. They always flounder. And that's one of the problems. They need to have a focus. It can't be anti-this. It's time we engage in pro-democracy, and that means that we establish the basic conditions of representing the American people. And one of these basic conditions is, if you voted yes, we vote no. You're out in 2006, and that has to become the mantra. If you voted yes for war, we vote no, and you're out. And it's time that we start growing a new generation of American leaders. Why do we continue to allow special interests in these various parties, whether it be Republican Party or Democratic Party, to put such awful choices up before the American people to represent them in positions of extreme importance? The fact that George W. Bush and John Kerry were the two choices we had in the last election is the most harsh indictment of the system we have in place today.
This requires some speculation, but it's pertinent and probably interesting. Given Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq War and subsequent posture on this question, how do you think she would shape Iraq policy were she to make it to the presidency?
Hillary's the classic chicken hawk. She doesn't know anything about the military. She doesn't know anything about national service. She's a woman that now, because she is so weak on national defense, and frankly, that's a reflection of a terminal illness within the Democratic Party as a whole, a weakness on national security. So she has to be more right-wing than the right-wingers, and she's going to head us even to worse problems in Iraq than the Bush administration. I don't know, Syed, if you disagree or...
Well, I just am appalled that our former President Clinton says nothing. I think it's shameful. It's just shameful. You know, let me say something. About a month ago, the Democrats, some of the leading theorists, including Sandy and Madeleine Albright, had a secret meeting in Washington. Secret meeting, hasn't been reported yet, as far as I can tell, in which they have debated what to do. And they ended up concluding, the general conclusion was, to the horror of some, was that, well, the Republicans are floundering now. Let's do nothing, let's say nothing, and let them bottom out. And the notion that the leadership would let more Americans and Iraqis and others perhaps die, and Afghanistans die, because they might be able to steal Kentucky or Georgia away from the Republican Party, you know, if they go quiet, is really so abhorrent. And one just says, I'll tell you what I saw that was very interesting in the last election. I saw the Democratic Party devalued in many of the, particularly in the Middle West. I saw the unions doing a great job. I saw ACORN. I saw a lot of public interest groups. MoveOn.org, is it, whatever. I saw a lot of groups that are not necessarily from all different classes work together in a very effective way. And I think that's what's going to happen, is I think people are just going to do what Scott said. I think they're going to find better candidates, and it's going to be, I think the Democratic Party is going to be forced to be more coherent on this issue. Well, I don't know. We always seem to have somebody. We've got 2 years. I can get, you know, when I was a kid reporter, 1800 years ago, I left the Associated Press. I covered the war. I was covering the Pentagon, and I learned by the fall of 1967, I really did understand that we were doomed, that this was a horrible event. And so I quit and went to work for Gene McCarthy, because he was the only guy then that was willing to stand up against Lyndon Johnson, his own party, and say, I'm against this war. And it'll happen again. And here's a really safe prediction to somebody who wants to be a national leader. The next guy that goes public, the next senior politician, Democrat, that goes public firmly and solidly against the war, he's got a shoe-in.
This question for Cy Hirsch. How much direct influence does Vice President Cheney have on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and the conduct of the war?
Well, I mean, you've just got the guy. I mean, this is the key guy. It's more than that, I would say, on the president. I mean, you know, I there's no question that Cheney has been the single force. And one of the great mysteries, I think that historians are going to have to try and struggle with is he did not sign some of those manifestos in 97 and 98 with Wolfowitz and the others, Doug Feith. He was always a realist. He was always a hardliner. He did not, and he was somebody who supported the decision in 91 not to go to Baghdad when Bush's father was under pressure to do so. If you read and hear some of the things he said running for the vice presidency in 2000 and what he said, he was not that way. What turned Cheney after 9/11 into the raging? And what? Oh, yeah, well, You know, it's there's a we know nothing about this White House. You got it. That's a given. We know nada. They just operate in ways that we can't see.
Again, in the category of speculation, had Gore won in 2000, would U.S. still have invaded Iraq or pursued in some other way regime change in Iraq?
Gore did win is the easy answer.
I know I just wrote one book, and that's the one people should be focused on. But I did write another book back in 1999 called Endgame. And I discussed the issue of America's Iraq policy. And I said, look, the policy we're on is a policy of inevitable confrontation. There's no out. There's no vehicle for diplomacy. It's about regime change. And so inevitably what's going to happen is as we push and push and push, we're going to hit a wall where we either have to turn left and capitulate, and no American politician is going to capitulate on the issue of Iraq, or we're going to turn right and we have to confront decisively, militarily, and unilaterally. And this didn't matter if you're a Republican or you're a Democrat. Al Gore was married to the policy of regime change. Al Gore was married to a policy of deceiving the American people about the reality of Iraq. And if Al Gore had been elected in 2000, America would have ended up fighting Iraq. Maybe not along the lines that the Bush administration has pursued, but we would have had to confront Iraq.
Okay.
He's breaking your heart.
Let's go back to the Middle East. Scott, it seems that private security contractors are nothing more than mercenaries who have no accountability to the United States, to Iraq, or to international law. Is that you?
Well, it seems that way. Look, as somebody who served in the military, there's no greater honor than to serve your country in the armed forces of the United States of America. It's a wonderful thing because you take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It means something. It means a lot. It's actually a cause worthy of the sacrifice of life. I was willing and I am willing today to give my life in service of my country because I believe in something, because I believe in the Constitution, I believe in an oath. If your value basis for service becomes monetary, you stop being somebody who's serving because of honor, because of a cause, and you start becoming a mercenary, and there's no other way to describe it. Private contractors have no role whatsoever in the waging of conflict on behalf of the United States of America.
And let me just say, that was great, Scott, because you're right on. It's an incredible problem. They're outsourcing. There's a wonderful word we use, rendition, which is basically, disappearing. We called it 2 decades ago in Brazil and Argentina, just grabbing people. It's outsourced now. We outsource. We pay a group of retired CIA guys who have a company to go grab somebody. Perhaps it's a little more sophisticated than going into the jungle. But in Tal Afar, the one colonel who told me with great horror about what he saw there, he was there for three months. He said at various times the worst killers were teams of Iraqis led by an American, retired American special forces or CIA retired paramilitary guy who'd come back in as a mercenary, Salvadorian style, and going, they would go into these towns and villages where they thought there was trouble and just rip up people. And it's so prevalent and so demeaning to us, the extent to which this administration has resorted to this kind of thuggery and this kind of murder incorporated business. It's just shocking. It's something that Congress does not want to look at. It's something that the press, I've actually seen favorable stories about some of these killing teams, which is amazing to me. And I was talking about one in the New York Times magazine. Just amazing.
Could you summarize the role Saudi Arabia is playing in the region, and particularly in the Iraq imbroglio?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There isn't a major construction company or large Saudi business mostly, as you know, the Saudis are Sunni. That isn't financing the insurgency. There's just no question. And it's not just Saudi Arabia. All over the Sunni world in the Middle East, it's a matter of honor to support the insurgency. The insurgency in Iraq, the Sunni insurgency that's involved in this life and death struggle with us, is being financed by people who see what what we call insurgents, they see them as people defending themselves from the occupation, the wrongful occupation of the United States. I don't know if that's what I'm told. I don't know what you think or what you hear, Scott, about that issue.
I have to be honest and say that I'm probably not that equipped to answer the question about Saudi Arabia and what they're doing in Iraq, other than to note that the Saudi Arabian government has been struggling with the issue of Islamic fundamentalism in the form of Wahhabism, the sect of Sunni Islam that's been embraced by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. In Iraq today, in western Iraq, in the Sunni heartland, you see a resurgence of Wahhabism. And this is of great concern to the Saudi government. I think they would prefer a return to a secularism that's not there right now. We've denied the Sunnis of Iraq the right to exist as a people. We've taken that away from them. We've disenfranchised them. We've allowed the Kurds and the Shia, not as a people, but as individuals. Jalal Talabani, the president of Iraq today, is a Kurd who waged war against Saddam Hussein's government in the during the Iran-Iraq war. This is about revenge. Jafar is the head of Dawah, a terrorist organization sponsored by Iran that tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein. You look at this trial today that's taking place in Iraq. It's not about law. It's about revenge. Why did they pick the smallest crime that Saddam Hussein committed? Because it was a Dawah assassination attempt that went afoul, that Saddam Hussein attacked Dawah, and now Dawah's in power in Iraq today getting revenge. Saudi Arabia is very concerned about what's going on, and what's the vehicle to deal with this? Diplomacy? The United States has ruled out diplomacy. So it doesn't surprise me in the least that the Saudis would be funneling resources to selected Sunni insurgent groups.
As a matter of honor, and just as a final sort of... I think it's important for Americans to understand that we are fighting a war against the people we started the war against 2.5 years ago. In other words, we began a war against the Sunni Baathists. We did not win when Baghdad fell. All that happened is Saddam, before the war, set up a guerrilla operation, cell operation, insurgency, pre-planned it all. And we're now in year three of a war against the people we started. And a four-star general just the other day, he said to me, well, we're not winning it, and therefore we're losing it, in a sense. We're in the middle of in the third year of a war against the Baathist Sunni regime, with or without Saddam. They're fighting us, and they're fighting us pretty hard. And again, that's my interpretation. I just wonder how you see it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, there was no Missouri moment. The Iraqi government did not surrender. The Iraqi army did not lay down its arms. It was amazing. You talk to some people about the situation in Baghdad, and journalists saw this. On April 6th, there's roadblocks at every street corner manned by Special Republican Guard, Baathist militia, security forces, intelligence forces, all dug in. The whole town is armed to the teeth, ready to fight a block-by-block defense of Baghdad. On April 7th, they're all gone. Why? Because Saddam Hussein said, look, I'm not going to sacrifice Baghdad. You guys go, disappear. We have a plan. Let's implement the plan. You know, the Bush administration's criticized, rightly so, for not having a plan for post-war Iraq. Well, guess who did have a plan? Saddam Hussein. And his plan's trumping our lack of plan every single day we're in Iraq.
For both of you, a strangely underrepresented entity in this conversation, the United Nations. Is there a role, and can they be effective?
The United Nations is a membership. It's a club. And it only works if its members abide by the rules that they all agree upon. Those rules are embodied in the United Nations Charter. As an American, I need to point out that Article 6 of our Constitution states that when we enter into an agreement or treaty that's been ratified by two-thirds of the United States Senate, that is the law of the land. This is the Constitution. We have signed the United Nations Charter. And yet, on a daily basis, we violate that charter, not just in Iraq, but around the world. The United Nations will never succeed as an organization until the United States of America decides to be a full and responsible partner in accordance with the rules that we expect all other nations to abide by.
It's been said during the course of this evening's conversation that the U.S. presence does not have to be negative. Could each of you comment on what kind of presence would be positive?
You know, there is room. There's always room. This is the glass half full business. There is room. Iran is not, as Scott suggested, they're not nearly as intractable as one might think. They're sitting there looking at a nuclear reactor being built for peaceful use by the Russians. And they're saying to themselves, Chernobyl, Chernobyl, Chernobyl. They would love to get Western help in that reactor, because the Russians always deal sort of third-rate quality to their, that's one of their famous, they don't deal as straightforwardly with their allies as they should in terms of supplies and the best stuff. And so they're worried about it. There's a lot of room for negotiating with Iran if we were chose to. They are trying to make contact. I can tell you the Syrians, this I know an awful lot about. I've been reporting on something there for months. The Syrians are, there is no empirical evidence, by the way, and I'm sure the German will come up with none either, Mehlis, about who killed Hariri. That doesn't mean that the Syrians didn't do it. It doesn't mean that anybody didn't do it. We just don't know. And the Syrians want to play. And so we could actually, as bad as it is, nobody, as Scott said earlier, there's no virtue in chaos in Iraq. And yet, when you have a cult, cults always have, by definition, they have a public and a private meeting. In the cult, the Wolfowitz Fight cult, the public rendition is, let's talk about democracy. Privately, they all agree on chaos. Chaos works for these guys. You know, chaos actually is a plus in their eyes. Chaos in the Middle East works. And that's why they're not unhappy with this. Yep. So we're really in trouble.
What I would say on that is, can the United States have a positive role? Something good, a presence that is positive, not negative? And the answer is, of course we can. Look, we stand for so many good things, and the world knows that. As bad as this administration has been, as bad as the Clinton administration was, the world still looks to us to be leaders on many things. The key thing about leadership, though, and again, I learned this in the military, your best leaders aren't people who shout and dictate. Your best leaders are those who lead by example, who motivate. And when we talk about the United Nations, you know, the United States going to the United Nations and being an effective member is not a capitulation of American sovereignty. It's actually the best chance for America to display the leadership skills that the world so sadly needs and so sadly wants. And that's the positive role that the United States could be playing today.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank the cameras from C-SPAN and Democracy Now! And people from Nation Magazine. Victor Navasky is here with us tonight, Nation Books, and our two panelists for helping us to widen the scope of this incredibly critical challenge that faces our country. And I'd like to thank both of you very much for giving us your time.